I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stars and Stripes Honor Flight has honored more than 4,100 veterans from southeastern Wisconsin since 2008, taking World War II, Korean War veterans, and terminally ill veterans of any conflict to their memorials in Washington, D.C. They are sent off with bands and many well-wishers in return to a similar kind of greeting. Now they're hosting their first book club discussion on Saturday, February 27 at Concordia University in Mequon. Local Korean War veterans will lead a panel discussion on devotion, an epic story of heroism, friendship, and sacrifice. The book tells the inspirational story of Korean War veteran Tom Hudner and Ensign Jesse Brown, Tom White, Jesse Black, and they came from very, very different backgrounds. It's really a moving story. The author, Adam Makos, who is one of our guests this hour, will be virtually attending the meeting, and Dick Barr, Staff Sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, will be there if he is feeling well enough to do so. He'll be with us this hour later on. He served in the Korean War and fought in the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. He lives in Oconomowoc. There are 30,000 Korean War veterans in Wisconsin, according to Stars and Stripes. That's quite a few, and it is a forgotten war, and we will not forget it this hour. Joining us, the first part of the program is Adam Makos. As I said, his book is Devotion, an epic story of heroism, friendship, and sacrifice. Adam is the author of the New York Times bestseller, A Higher Call, and he has interviewed countless veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and present-day battles. He's been inspired by his grandfather's World War II stories. He also has flown a World War II bomber, accompanied a special forces raid in Iraq, and organized this expedition into North Korea with Tom Hudner in search of we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but in search of a missing in action American serviceman. And the story is a tender one and gives us history not only of the Korean War, but also of the racial issues of the time, the late 1940s and the early 1950s. Adam, thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for writing this book. Hi.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. It is amazing to me. I think of Korea as being not in that too distant a past, but the Korean War began over 65 years ago now, 1950.
And the anniversary, that 65th year, it's gone by in silence. I mean, there were ceremonies, there was pomp and circumstance. Even the anniversary of the Korean War is forgotten.
Why is that? Why have we forgotten this war? Is it because it ended in a virtual tie?
I think that's a lot of it. I think Americans love a victory, and we don't know how to handle a tie. I think sometimes we think of a tie just like we think of a defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And because the war started on the 38th parallel and it ended at the same place with a North Korea and with a South Korea, we look at it and we say, we lost that one. Really, we kept 50 million South Koreans free. That's how many are living in freedom today.
Mm-hmm. And it was a difficult war for so many. We'll talk with one of the veterans, but some of these battles were in temperatures that were just terribly inhumane. It was freezing, freezing cold, wasn't it?
It certainly was. And the battle that Tom Hudner's story centers around was fought at the Chosin Reservoir, and it was negative 20 degrees below zero. And our guys were out in that for 2 weeks straight. No warm shower, no warm tent, negative 20 degrees, you know, sub-zero temperatures for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Your story centers on, and there had been, as you remind us, Tuskegee Airmen who flew in the 1940s. But the Navy had washed out any black cadet trying to become a naval aviator. So the person that you highlight in your book, Jesse Brown's story, is so historic on so many levels, isn't it?
It really is. I call him a one-man Tuskegee Airman because the Navy did not crack until 1949. There were actually 900 Tuskegee Airmen during World War II, but the Navy didn't allow one black fighter pilot in. And the way Jesse succeeded, and we can talk a lot about who this young man was, but he got very lucky. He had a flight instructor who was a farm boy from Oklahoma, and Jesse was a farm boy from Mississippi.
Hmm.
And this flight instructor said, I'm going to judge you on how you fly, not the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. Jesse said, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I want.
And Jesse was at Ohio State University?
Yeah, Jesse came from very humble circumstances. He was from Mississippi, the Deep South. He grew up in the years just before World War II, and he was a sharecropper's son. And so he was dirt poor. He was living in a veritable shack. And when a plane would fly overhead when he was out working the fields, just like the movies, you know, barefoot under a blistering sun, he would say to the other sharecroppers, someday I'm going to fly. And I'm not just going to fly. I'm going to fly for the U.S. Navy. He got that crazy idea from the magazines he would read at night by the lamplight at the side of his bed. And he just set his mind to it. And that led him to Ohio State. And he was very lucky. Had he gone to another school, he would have never seen, if he had gone to an all-black school, he would have never seen their Navy recruiting posters mm-hmm. for the pilots, because they wouldn't ever post them at a school like that. But at Ohio State, it was a rare instance where Jesse saw it and he said, I'm going to try.
You write about his walking home from school with his brothers and being spat upon by kids who were in a school bus, and the school bus driver really sticking up for him, but learning from his mother, which must have been a very difficult thing, and he had to encounter this kind of prejudice, really, from some of the African Americans who were the stewards on the Navy ship as well. But this is interesting what his mom said. Words can have all the power in the world or none at all. The choice is yours. So Jesse, you write, would face a mirror hour after hour to insult himself.
Can you imagine that?
No.
I mean, it would be after dinner and the family would be out brushing their teeth on the porch. They didn't even have running water. And Jesse would get in front of that mirror, and he would curse himself. And he slowly taught himself to let the words just go right over him, to let it slide off his back. And once he was able to do that, you couldn't give him an ethnic slur. You couldn't curse him, and you couldn't rile him. And he also learned from his mother that same lesson. You know, the way you use words, the way you carry yourself, is how people will form their opinions of you. And so he went to great pains to speak properly and to carry himself well. And that's why he was able to fit in so well in every environment. He came from nothing, but he became the first black fighter pilot in 1949. He wore those wings. And when he fit, when he was assigned to his squadron, nobody saw his color. All the guys said, he's just one of the boys.
Mm-hmm. And the other person who's highlighted is Tom Hudner, who couldn't have had a more different kind of background. The son of well-to-do people, the son of privilege, right? Going to go to Harvard.
Yes, Tom was born up in New England, so he's at the other side of the world from Jesse, and he's born into a different lifestyle. He was supposed to take over the family business, the grocery store chain. He was supposed to go to Harvard like his father had before him. Instead, he had this idea that he wanted to attend the Naval Academy. He wanted to serve his country because his country was at war. And Tom just missed out on World War II. And he joined the fleet in the year that the war ended. And he wound up in fighter planes when he could have been living a very cushiony life.
And what about his ideas on racial equality? When he met Jesse, the two of them, he shook his hand, and Jesse didn't expect that to happen. Where was he informed? Because he was living in an era where the races didn't get to know each other very well, but he was right there. He put his hand out.
Well, Tom's parents had taught him to judge a man by his character, and they were a good, tight Catholic family. And so Tom had a sense of right and wrong from the beginning. And when he met Jesse, their first meeting was awkward. Everybody thinks that they just would ride off into the sunset and be best friends. Jesse held back his hand, and finally Tom got him to shake his hand, and later Jesse explained. He said, you know, Tom, a lot of times in flight training, I would go up to another cadet or another pilot, and I'd say, hi, I'm Jesse Brown, and that man would keep his hand at his side. So Jesse said, I don't force myself on anyone anymore. And Tom said, you'll never have that problem with me. And so that day a friendship was born, a friendship that would carry them to the ends of the earth.
Yes, it sure did, and then some. This was a dangerous thing they were doing, to fly these planes. Tell me about the planes, and to be able to land a plane on a carrier, and then the work that they were doing in Korea as well. It was really dangerous work.
It really was. These young men were the Top Gun pilots of 1950, and they flew the hot rod aircraft of World War II. It was the Corsair fighter. And so they're flying World War II technology, and they're landing on carriers. It was easily the most dangerous job in the world because this aircraft was fast, and it had low visibility. It was meant for dogfighting, and they had to come in and land on this little spot on a carrier. And they said when you'd be circling the carrier, you would look down, and it would look like a postage stamp or a piece of driftwood floating on that sea of blue, and they had to land on it. And so these men were the cream of the crop. Now, their specialty in combat was ground support. So they weren't necessarily the guys chasing around other planes to shoot them down. Their job was to support the Marines and the Army on the ground and to drop bombs and to drop napalm, to basically fight the enemy from above and to give our boys on the ground a fighting chance.
Mm-hmm. And the boys on the ground, we'll hear from one of them during that chosen battle, were facing really, really difficult fighting circumstances. And then this enemy, this Chinese enemy that they didn't see coming.
Exactly. The Korean War took an awful turn. Nobody saw the war coming, and nobody saw it becoming what it was. You know, we thought the war was going to be won in November 1950. We thought the United Nations had triumphed. We were about to kick the North Koreans out of their own country, established democracy, and all of a sudden the Chinese entered the war, and the Chinese brought so many men, so many armies. We were literally taken by surprise. It was a surprise attack on a level never seen before. And that's where our Marines were surrounded in the east, our Army was surrounded in the west, and their lifeline was men like Tom and Jesse, the flyboys coming from the carriers offshore.
Mm-hmm. And were they, you mentioned they were flying these older planes. I have read that there's been criticism from some people who fought in Korea that they just didn't have the equipment that they should have. Did we not prepare ourselves in terms of planes, in terms of guns, for fighting this war?
I think America thought with the end of World War II, our days of fighting were over. I mean, we reduced the Marine Corps to the point where to fight these battles, they had to go around to embassies. They had to go to the ships. They had to take the guards out of the embassies, and they had to take the reserves, and they had to send these guys into combat. America thought the war was over. We were scrapping our planes. We were mothballing our ships. Everybody was ready for a decade of peace, and nobody saw what would this conflict that was almost like World War III in a lot of ways, because before you knew it, you had about 20 nations fighting on the Korean Peninsula. You had the Soviets, you had the Chinese, you had the North Koreans, and then you had the United Nations. So the Australians were fighting, the English were fighting, the French were fighting. It was almost a world war. Some people say it was World War III. It was just never declared.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about whether or not a nuclear option was ever seriously considered?
Well, it was seriously considered by Douglas MacArthur, General MacArthur. He wanted to invade China. He wanted to fight communism on a much larger level. And President Truman knew that invading China, perhaps using atomic weapons, could draw the Soviet Union into an outright shooting war. Because the Soviets, up until that point, were advising the Chinese. They were advising the North Koreans. They were giving them weapons and planes. But they weren't actually fighting. MacArthur was willing to take that risk, and Truman said, no, we're not about to start a nuclear holocaust over the Korean Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. The friendship, let's go back to the friendship between Tom and Jesse. They really relied on each other. And we can move ahead in the story because it's a phenomenal story, what happened. Jesse loses his life. Can you tell us about that battle and how Tom tried to save him? And then it's okay for us to jump ahead many years ago when Tom goes to North Korea. You went with him. It's an amazing story.
It's a story of lifelong devotion.
Yes.
On Tom's part. When Jesse was shot down December 4th, 1950, they were supporting the Marines at the Chosin Reservoir when a Chinese bullet hit his oil tank, and he lost his oil, and he crash-landed his plane in the only place he could, on the side of a North Korean mountain. And so it was a violent crash. He was trapped in the wreckage of his fighter, and it was catching fire. Smoke was rising from the nose, and Jesse couldn't get out. Now, overhead, Tom looked down. He's his friend, and he saw Jesse waving. Nobody knew why he wasn't getting out, but Tom knew he had to act. Jesse had a young wife, Daisy. He had a little daughter, Pamela. And he was Tom's friend. And so Tom, at that moment, made a split-second decision to do something that has never been repeated since. It had never been attempted before. He said, I'm going in. Hmm. And he crash-landed, intentionally crash-landed, with the wheels up, his Corsair fighter, and he came to a skidding stop on that mountainside alongside of Jesse's plane. And he opened his canopy, he hopped out into the snow, and he set out to try to save his friend's life.
Wow. How did he get out of there?
Well, Jesse was helplessly pinned.
Yeah.
And so Tom used his bare hands to fight the fire, and he squelched the fire, and he bundled Jesse for warmth, and he waited at his side, and he waited as the sun set, as the temperatures grew colder, and slowly Jesse was succumbing. And at one point, Jesse said, Tom, I need you to do something for me. Just tell Daisy how much I love her. And those were his last words to his wife. And Tom said, I'll do that. By the time the helicopter came to pull Tom from that mountain, Jesse had died.
Hmm.
And he died not alone, but with his friend at his side.
Hmm.
And it was terrible for Tom to have to leave him. But before he left, he shouted, he said, Jesse, we don't have the tools to free you, but we'll be back. Somehow, some way, we'll be back for you. Now, Jesse never heard him. Jesse was already gone by then. But Tom made that promise, and he never forgot that promise.
And we'll talk about his going back to get the remains, which our guest, the author, accompanied Tom on that journey. On so many levels, as you can tell, it's a really interesting story, this friendship between this white man and this black man who achieves history in the U.S. Navy fighting this war that is a forgotten war, going back, Adam did with Tom, to get the remains of Jesse so many years later, and how all of that was arranged. And now this book becoming a book that Korean War veterans are reading for Stars and Stripes and having a book discussion of, so they can start talking about their experiences and center in on this story of courage and friendship and sacrifice. So we're welcoming phone calls. I'm particularly interested. We'll be speaking with a Korean War vet later in the show, but I'm interested in hearing from at least a couple of the many thousands of you who served in the Korean War who can talk about your experiences and talk about the attention that Stars and Stripes is focusing now on this group of veterans. Our phone number, I would hope that maybe a few of you have had a chance to read Adam's book. It's just been released, Devotion, an Epic Story of Heroism, Friendship, and Sacrifice. Adam Makos is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. WPR.org, or our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to read your comments there. We're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we're speaking this hour with Adam Makos, who's the author of Devotion, an Epic Story of Heroism, Friendship, and Sacrifice. Let's jump ahead to just a couple years ago, just about 63 years after the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. Tom goes to North Korea to try to find his friend's remains, and you went with him. This must have been quite a journey.
It really was, Kathleen. When I was writing the book, I got to that part where Tom made that promise to Jesse, and I called him up, and I said, Tom, did you ever get to go back to North Korea? I mean, he had a long Navy career. He retired as a captain. And I said, Tom, did you ever get to keep that promise? He said, no, nobody goes to North Korea. You just can't do it. Well, I had a friend who had a friend who...
Right.
Well, let's just say, yeah, they had been there. And and so I said, Tom, if we can do this, would you go? And he said, you bet I will. Now, Tom was, at the time, 89 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, can you...
No,
can
I
you
can't imagine...
And he, that promise that he made to Jesse had stayed with him his whole life, to the point where at age 89 when some of his family and friends cautioned him. They said, don't go to North Korea. You may never come home. But he said, I have a promise to keep. And he went. And I got to tag along with him. And I watched him sit down across from the North Korean army. Now, we're talking about the most feared army on earth, the enemies of America. And he told them, he said, I need you to look for my friend Jesse Brown. His remains are on a mountainside, and we need to bring him home. We need to bring him home for his family and for his country.
Hmm. What did they say?
Well, they said, today the search continues. So it's ongoing. They haven't necessarily found Jesse yet. They're searching for him. The trouble is, Jesse's lost on a mountainside that's forgotten by time. You know, he's in the wreckage of his fighter plane. It's very difficult to find him. So we're hoping someday we're going to get a call that says they did it.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows, Kathleen, who knows? It's such an opaque and intransigent regime. We don't know.
Right.
We just can't get an honest answer.
Yeah, right, I understand. And Tom was no spring chicken, 89 years old. That was an arduous trip, wasn't it? He must be a pretty healthy man.
He really was. And just the bravery. But you think about it, how he earned the Medal of Honor. Because he earned the Medal of Honor, our nation's highest award, trying to save Jesse's life. How did he do that? He took an incredible risk.
Yes.
When he went back to North Korea, it was the same Tom Hudner who did the impossible. You know, crash landing a plane on a mountainside, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Going to North Korea, it's crazy, but that's who Tom Hudner is. He puts other people before himself.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655, and Bob is our first caller. Hi, Bob.
I just want to say thank you. I haven't heard this story since I was a kid. I'm in my late 50s, and my dad served in China, just a grunt job, U.S. Marine, taking care of Corsairs, and then he went back for Korea. And I didn't get a lot of stories, but all I knew was he served on a carrier in Korea, and there was some guy that got a Medal of Honor.
Mm.
And all of a sudden today, I get to hear this story. So I'm going to buy copies of the book for all my kids. And thank you very much.
Oh, I'm so glad you were listening today, Bob. You hope to reach people like that with this book, don't you? And all the Korean War veterans. That's quite a story. Adam?
It's a great honor to be able to change the way people look at a generation of warriors. I mean, we forget that the Korean War veterans were part of the greatest generation.
Right.
The same generation that won World War II, they also fought the Korean War. But when we see a veteran with a hat that says World War II, we thank him for his service and we respect him and we've seen the movies and the TV shows. But when we see a Korean War veteran, what do we know other than the show MASH? And so we're trying to give a new face to the Korean War. We're trying to give a legacy to these men who have been forgotten. And so it's the greatest honor to hear calls like that one.
Mm-hmm. And he said he's hearing this story for the first time, and it ties in with his father, which puts his father in a certain place with certain characters. But I read that this story of the two of them must be a story that has circulated in military circles that people have been proud of.
Mm-hmm. It's a legendary story in military circles. You know, Jesse Brown was a figure of history. I think of him like a Jackie Robinson,
yes,
Jesse
right.
Owens.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have been as well known as them if he had lived. If he had lived, who knows what wonderful things he might have done. He might have became a senator. He might have became the first black admiral. He would have been a trailblazer. And right now, our country needs stories like this because the relations between white people and black people, you know, we need to study men like Tom and Jesse and see how this friendship was formed and how these two men would go to the ends of the earth for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because back when Jesse joined the military, Truman had just desegregated the military, 1948. And he said that white men and black men could fight side by side. They would live and die for each other. And a lot of people said, no, that's impossible. That will never happen. Well, the story of Tom and Jesse changed things. It proved Truman was right, and it set the tone for the future of the U.S. military.
Why did we have the Tuskegee Airmen, but it took the Navy so much longer to embrace African Americans and allow them to perform it at their highest level?
Well, the Navy is known for, especially the Aviator Corps, there are so few of them. So on a ship of 3,000 men, you typically have about 100 pilots. They were very elite, and so you only had a certain number of carriers. Basically, there were more Army pilots like the Tuskegee Airmen. And so the Navy was able to have this little boys' club, and it was basically just, you know, it was unofficial policy of the flight instructors. We're just not going to allow a black pilot to pass through our classes.
Hmm.
And so part of the way Jesse made it was his instructor, but also part of it was because you couldn't help but love the guy.
Hmm.
He was just cheerful, and he was optimistic, and he never went looking for a problem. He just said, I'm here to do my job. I'm here to serve my country. And when you think about it, he wanted to serve a country that wouldn't serve him if he walked into the wrong restaurant or bar. And there's a story, Kathleen.
Oh, I love this story. Yeah, tell it.
Right. He's about to go to war. It's his last night on American soil. And one of the World War II veterans, one of the pilots in their squadron, said, all right, we're gathering everybody at the bar at a beautiful hotel in downtown San Diego. He said, we're going to have martinis, and we're going to celebrate we're going to war. Well, Jesse was there, and the waiter came up to him, and he skipped him, and he went right to the next pilot. And that World War II veteran called the waiter over. He said, you missed this man's order. And he said, sir, we don't serve blacks here.
Mm.
This is California, San Diego, California, August 1950. And they wouldn't serve Jesse Brown on his last night on American soil. And so all the pilots that night, they got up, they left their drinks, they didn't pay their tabs, and they stormed out of that bar in a sign of unity. And they went to war the next day.
Oh, my goodness. And that wasn't even the story I thought you were going to tell. That's a great story. The other story was when he was evidently doing bartending at home, and he was at a place where officers were and naval officers were, and he hadn't been treated very well. It was kind of a lot of racial epithets thrown in his direction. But then when they find out he's going off to college, they take up a collection for him and raise a huge amount of money so he can go to Ohio State.
Exactly. And, yes, that is the other story. That's the other one. And see, the beauty of this book, Devotion, is it's not a book that says, oh, let's look at persecution, let's look at racial injustice. It's really a book that says, let's look at how people come together. And so those soldiers, those were white soldiers down at Camp Shelby, and they took their money out and they filled the hat for Jesse Brown. So for every story of someone who did something awful to him, there's a story of the good people who stood behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the men in his squadron. It was the strangers in that bar. It was men like Tom Hudner.
Our guest this hour is Adam Makos. He's the author of Devotion, an epic story of heroism, friendship, and sacrifice. It's a beautiful friendship story. It's also a look at those who served in the Korean War, and there are many of them. The Forgotten War, who those people are starting to get long overdue attention. Korean War began over 65 years ago, June 25th. It started in 1950, claiming 40,000 American lives. This looks at the war, and it also looks at this friendship between two people who were very important in their naval work, flying these small planes, and one of them lost his life and had to crash land his plane in North Korean territory, and his friend, Jesse Owens, who was African-American, and his friend, Tom Hudner, who was a white privileged guy, very deep of deepest of friends, and Tom tried to risk his own life to try to save him, and then went back to North Korea to try to get Jesse's remains, Jesse Brown, Jesse Owens, I was thinking of the runner, many, many years later when Tom was 89 years old, because he promised Jesse that he would bring him home, and that was the final act of bringing him home. So far not successful, but maybe it will happen. So we're welcoming phone calls. Our phone number 800-486-8655, as we talk about the Korean War as well. We'll be joined by a Korean War vet in just a moment. I thought it was pretty wonderful of you, the way you met Tom and wrote this book. You ran into him at a conference. You heard him speak. Is that right?
Yeah, I was a young magazine writer at the time, writing about World War II veterans. And so I attended a history conference in Washington, D.C., and it was the last day, everybody was leaving, and there he was across the lobby of the hotel, just reading his newspaper with his travel bag at his side, and it was Tom Hudner. And I had a little inkling as to who he was and what he had done, and I went up to him, I said, "Sir, can I tell your story?" The thing that interested me, and he gave me his business card, and he said, "Call me." He said, "I'd love to talk to you."
Hmm.
What interested me was I knew what he did. I knew he crash-landed his aircraft intentionally to save his friend. Nobody had ever done that. It was crazy. What I didn't know was, what kind of man was Tom Hudner? What kind of man would do that? How do you psychologically become a person who would do something like that? And what was so great about Jesse Brown that a man like Tom would risk everything to try to save him? Because he didn't just crash land on a North Korean mountain. He crash landed in the snow, sub-zero temperatures, behind enemy lines. There were 100,000 Chinese troops between him and safety.
Mm.
And there was a good chance that helicopter wasn't going to come and save him.
Right, right.
Tom could have died on that mountainside right alongside of Jesse Brown, and we'd be telling a very different story to this day.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
Peter, our next caller in Madison. Hello, Peter.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about my father's experience during World War II. He was put in command of an infantry platoon of black volunteers in Europe, and they had been called for volunteering for combat out of truck driving, service corps, hospital orderlies, stevedores, and jobs like that. And he brought a platoon up and mixed it in with his company in Germany and led them through the rest of the war. It's early days, and the Army was really hard up for having enough bodies on the line, and so they made that decision. It was temporary. Of course, they were resegregated as soon as the war was over, but that's just, my father's still alive, and he likes to tell stories about what those guys were like.
Hmm. I'm glad he likes to tell those stories. Adam?
Well, it's those are the best stories. I mean, I think we Americans, we want to see more of those stories. It's the stories of, you know, we turn on the news and we get one story about racial relations. And I sometimes wonder if the news likes to play up the worst things and fan the flames and make us think things are worse. And then you see the good stories. And those are the ones we need to keep telling ourselves. And those are the ones we need to believe. The stories when a sharecropper's son can become friends with a blue blood from New England, a one percenter. That's an American story, and these are both American heroes. And I just want people, and it's great because you see people saying, "I love Jesse Brown, I love Tom Hudner," and skin color goes right out the window, and that's how it should be in this country.
We're going to welcome more phone calls and introduce a Korean War vet to our conversation in just one moment. We're having the conversation thanks to our being alerted by the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight in southeastern Wisconsin. They have flown the wonderful events. If you know nothing about it, they've been taking World War II vets. Those vets are dying off in a huge way now, so they're taking more Korean War veterans and any veteran who has a terminal illness to Washington, D.C., to the area where they can see their memorial and other war memorials. Now they're having this book club discussion. It's a great thing. Saturday, February 27 at Concordia University in Mequon. We'll have details. We'll put them on our Facebook page, Scotty. Can we do that so you'll know how to register in case you would like to go? Everybody's reading this book, and we're talking with the author this hour, Devotion, an epic story of heroism, friendship, and sacrifice. The author author is Adam Makos, and there will be local Korean War veterans leading a panel discussion of this book, and Adam will be beamed in via Skype or, you know, modern technology, and he'll be also talking about the book, and it should generate one heck of a conversation. It is an inspirational story of the Korean War, and Tom Hudner and Lieutenant Tom Hudner and Ensign Jesse Brown. So we're talking about it this hour. We'll meet our Korean War veteran and continue with Adam in a moment, and continue with your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we introduce to our conversation a Korean War veteran is joining us, Dick Barr, Staff Sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, who served during the Korean War and fought in the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. He lives in Oconomowoc. Dick, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you with us. Are you reading the book?
Yes. I'm on page 219.
Oh, my goodness. You really are reading the
Devotions.
Book.
Devotions. Yes, right.
Yeah. I think this is a great idea to have people read the same book and then have this book club discussion among vets, don't you think?
Yes, it very is. Very interesting when you get a bunch together who can talk about, especially somebody that's been there.
Right. How old were you when you went into the Marine Corps, Dick?
Oh, the first time I enlisted in the Marine Corps, I was 17.
Oh, you were so young, weren't you?
I was off the farm at that time. So, but then I stayed in the Marine Corps for the first 2 years, and afterwards was recalled for Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into Korea with the 1st Marine Division.
And what did you have as your guiding mission, what you put in your head and what you put in your soul when you were fighting in Korea? What was your mission?
Well, that's kind of hard to say because I probably really had more than one mission. It was to fight to stay alive and to fight the enemy that we had against us, which was so numerous that it was seemed impossible for us to get out of there. When we were fighting with the, and they came in waves of hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, well, it was like a nightmare.
Yeah, I bet it was like a nightmare. And this was specifically, you're referencing the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. You were there.
Yes. I was at the Chosin.
Mm-hmm.
I was with the 1st Marine Division, 1st Battalion, Baker Company, at the Chosin Reservoir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was cold.
Oh, yeah. All cold. Yeah, you couldn't put enough on to keep warm. Even though you had all your clothes on that you carried with you, you couldn't put more on because you didn't have them. But we sure needed them.
Yeah.
Because it was, wind was blowing, snowing at the same time, and we were fighting. So that was quite a time to remember.
And at what point, Dick, did you realize that something big was happening, that you thought, if I had this right, you were on the way to retreating, to getting out of that area, and all of a sudden you turn around and there are a huge number of Chinese forces? When did you see that happen, and did that come as a huge surprise to you and your fellow Marines?
No, not really, because we were up far enough heading towards the Yalu River at that time, and we were ordered to stop because the 5th Marines had taken off ahead of us, but the 5th Marines had dropped back because they were being charged by the Chinese, and we had captured some Chinese prior to that, so we had some knowledge of what was happening before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But we were encircled at the reservoir at that time. So that was sort of a surprise because we didn't figure there were that many hundreds of thousands of Chinese in the area because nobody had reported them.
Mm. You were encircled. What did you do? You were encircled.
Well, it, like they say, you just have to fight your way out. So we did. A gentleman by the warrior by the name of Oliver Prince Smith was the commander at that time. He was the division commander, and we were out on the right flank, you might say. We were left out there, hanging there, but the main body was quite a few miles away, and we were ordered to fight our way back. But Charlie Company had come to somebody's rescue, but we first had to rescue Charlie Company. So we did rescue them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese had them surrounded, too.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to annihilate everybody that they could.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't work that way. I think the annihilation was backwards. Us taking the advantage that we did, superior Air Force.
Right.
Our command in the field of people who had been in war, like some of the officers and men that we had,
mm-hmm.
so that we could fight our way out. It was no surprise to a lot of people, the fighting, because that's what we were trained for.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we did have problems with the cold weather. As somebody has said, that it was so cold. It was cold.
Right.
A lot of people froze after they were wounded.
Yeah.
That was a big problem, of trying to keep a man warm after he had been hurt.
I can't imagine. Yeah.
So, but our corpsmen and our hospital people should be very graduate, because of the work that they did in such severe conditions.
Yes, I have read, Adam, and you're a military historian, really, too, that this battle at Chosin Reservoir was comparable in some ways to the Battle of the Bulge.
Well, that could very well be. It was so cold, and the Battle of the Bulge was fought in Germany, you're talking about, right?
Yes.
And the weather conditions for the actual person who had lived in comfort, you might say, had never suffered in such cold.
Mm-hmm.
So it really did take lives. I've seen men who, when we had a chance to, they built an airstrip at the Hagerou Rhee, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
when General Smith had ordered a landing strip made, and some men that got on, I can remember reading one book in Colder Than Hell, that's Joe Owen's book, and in Chosin, where the men were getting on and they were trying to limit those that were wounded. And the men were standing out there, and one man said, well, he hauled up his foot and broke off his big toe, and he said, there you go.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Well, Adam, do you make comparisons to the Battle of the Bulge?
Oh, I sure do. It's like Battle of the Bulge and Valley Forge, and combined. But men like Dick, they pulled off one of the greatest feats in military history, and he can't say it, but us historians can. I mean, 10,000 men surrounded by 100,000, and our guys march out of that trap with their heads held high.
Yeah.
And those Chinese that they fought never went back to battle. They destroyed those two Chinese armies.
Mm. And how do you think they were able to accomplish it? Was it also because we were talking about how the weapons weren't terrific the Americans had, but the Chinese must have been worse?
Well,
submachine guns.
I'm sorry, I missed that, Dick. What did you say?
Pardon?
Submachine guns. What were you saying about submachine guns?
The Chinese had a lot of submachine guns. Some of these, it's been told, that I read somewhere, that we had shipped machine guns to our own people, but they were intercepted.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese got them instead.
Oh.
So we were up against our own weapons, you might say. some of our the submachine guns that they had. We captured a few. I had picked up two of them. But along the way, yes, the firepower that they had from so many hundreds of men, what would you say it would be like? A fly flying into a cobweb or something?
Mm-hmm.
That would be an illustration of it.
Mm.
Yes, something like that.
Mm-hmm. How do you get all those images out of your mind? It's interesting when I hear vets talk. It's as though you're bringing it to your eyes and your and to our eyes so many years later. Would you, have you wished that you could just not remember any of this?
Sometimes, yes. Yes, sometimes it does. Somebody asks me a question sometimes, and I have to wait before I answer them so I get it where it belongs. But sometimes it's all mixed up. Sometimes if I read something on it that's horrific about it and I go to bed and I can't sleep, then I wish I hadn't, yes?
Yeah.
Yes, there. I imagine there are others who have the same problem.
Well, I'm sure.
But it's men that stood like the flyers that we had. We didn't have enough of them, of course. But these people should be congratulated that a lot of people don't really understand what their problem was that they were devoted so to trying to help somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, when you talk to somebody about the Korean War, they say, oh, yeah, I know about that. And they pass it up. It's easily forgotten, I guess, because I don't know. What
yeah.
the real answer really is.
Maybe because we didn't win it, right, completely. It was, as we said earlier on, a tie. Let's take at least one phone call for both our guests and the small amount of time we have left. Mike in Adams County, hi.
Hi. Just wanted to share something about my father's experience in World War II. He and I were both drafted, and we were both graduates of Officers Candidate School. So we had a lot of military experience in common, but one time, and this is when I was an adult, you know, growing up, had a couple kids, et cetera, I wanted to sit down with a tape recorder and have him tell me about his experiences from World War II, and he absolutely refused.
Hmm.
And, you know, we never argued with Dad. Hmm. You know, he was a staunch disciplinarian, old school. And so it's always, you know, he's been dead since 2001, and yet I wish I could call him up and ask him
yes.
about his experience, I wish he had made that tape, but there was something
I know
that happened to him
mm-hmm.
that, you know, affected him that deeply his whole life.
Yeah, that's true of so many vets. Adam, in a brief amount of time, how did you get vets to open to you?
Well, I think there's just, it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time. At some point, the men find that it's up to them to talk, or else their buddies will be forgotten. And I think that's a big
yes.
part of it. They won't brag them about themselves, but, you know, they darn well don't want their to go to their grave and see their friends forgotten. The young men who died and are forever young, they died 65 years ago and their names are like dust, forgotten
mm-hmm.
by the wind. And that's why they talk, and that's why we got so many great stories. And I like to think devotion is bigger than the story of Tom. It's bigger than the story of Jesse Brown. It's the story of the chosen few Marines like Dick. It's the story of the young generation that fought the Korean War. And I say we won the Korean War. Because 50 million South Koreans live in freedom today, I call that a victory. So it's a love story, and it's a tribute to them.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. Dick, we'll have you back so we can talk to you for a much longer period of time. But thank you. Thanks to Dick Barr, Staff Sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps, served during the Korean War, and fought in the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, which sounded Oof, just terrific. He lives in Oconomowoc. Thank you, Dick, and we'll be in touch with you again. Adam Makos is the author of Devotion, an epic story of heroism, friendship, and sacrifice. And a reminder that this really, what a good idea this is. There's a book club discussion on the book, and Korean vets and others are going to be meeting to have a panel discussion on this book and talk about their experience in the Korean War. It should be a really, really good and meaningful event. It's February 27. More information on that on our Facebook page. Thanks to KP Whaley and Chris Molina for producing this program, and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We talk about Henry Kissinger and the Republican Party for 1 hour and then the other on tomorrow's program.